It's Ideasphere with Dr. Eric Luthart, Red Devil 4.
As we get better with creating better computers, we learn more about the brain. As we learn more about the brain, we improve the computers. And back and forth we go. And until, I think, again, we're going to see that boundary, that limitation between the two technologies start to disappear.
So you're looking forward to the day when computers and the human brain are connected via implants or some other device. This concept has been part of our thinking since scientist Isaac Asimov began toying with the idea of robotics and the human interface 40 years ago. And according to Dr. Eric Luthart, it's on the horizon. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with inventor and author, Dr. Eric Luthart. He's a neurosurgeon and biomedical engineer, as well as a recognized pioneer in neuroprosthetics. Luthart is the director of the Center for Innovation in Neuroscience and Technology at Washington University School of Medicine, where he researches brain-computer interfaces. In his book, he threads a story set 40 years in the future where 90% of the human population communicates and obtains information without cell phones or computers, thanks to the implantation of electronic devices in people's brains. Luthart's book is Red Devil 4, and he joins me for this program. But a note on this show, there's a bird in the room with him who, at times, takes part in the interview. Not disruptive, but I thought you'd like to know. Dr. Luthart, thanks for taking this time.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Guy.
I relished the book you wrote in reference to the possibility of neuroscience and technology, especially the inner workings of brain and computer in the future. Although I'm looking at that thinking, how many of us have put our thoughts into the potential of a virus or an invasion disrupting our thinking patterns, destroying the computer maybe?
You mean in terms of taking our tablet and whacking it against a desktop?
Exactly. Yes.
Well, you know, that certainly is true that maybe to even kind of encapsulate some of that thought is, so one person asked me in the past, well, wait a minute, this idea of putting an implant into my head sounds great, but when I work with my computer now, what, and it has a problem, that's okay because I can just take it to the max for what happens when it's inside my head.
And right.
So, you know, certainly this notion of, okay, once the new hardware is inside you, it takes on a new gravity, a new significance. And that's absolutely right. That means in some senses that the things that for the future will have such a higher level of reliability and capability that the current standards will simply be inadequate. And that, in some senses, is a good thing, meaning that if it is ready for it to be implanted in our heads, that it's got to be so good that it never fails and has to be proven so, then chances are it won't.
You're saying that it won't make it. It will not make it to market?
No, it will make it. For instance, there's many examples today of implantable hardware that we have that is absolutely critical for life-maintaining functions, such as a cardiac pacemaker, deep brain stimulators for Parkinson's. These are implanted electronics in our body that last for decades, and they do just fine. And so, you know, the point is people say, well, I have all these problems with my computer all the time. And it gets buggy. And once it's implanted, to get there, it has to be at such a high level of performance that it really will last you decades. So I think that the current experiences we have with our PCs in some senses will go away.
Okay, that makes more sense. I remember thinking a decade ago that it feels like we are in 1915 with the automobile, and we're having struggles not only with the mechanics, but with the roadways. All of that will eventually, you feel, be ironed out.
I think if it's going to be implanted, it has to be. It's a necessary step.
However, let's take it to step two. You've examined this even further. If we do go to the implant, or a skull cap, as I have heard some futurists theorize.
Mm-hmm.
If we do this, then what are the odds of something happening that you wrote about?
Right. So, you know, in my book, it is a cautionary tale. And it really tries to paint the good, the bad, and the ugly of what happens when there's prosthetics, these brain-computer interfaces implanted within us that give us amazing capabilities, the ability to share thoughts, to download experiences, to control machines with our thoughts alone, as if they're our bodies. But there is the dark side. And that dark side is broad. Some of the ways that I think about it is that just as we were splitting the atom, that it gave us nuclear power, but it also gave us the nuclear bomb. Today, as we see kind of the miracles of decoding DNA provide us with new medical therapies. People also talk about bioterrorism. That tomorrow, again, we're going to have great things that are going to be possible with the advance of human neurotechnology. But there's going to be some dark sides. And those will be variable, whether it be people creating things that are not good for your health. Meaning, in my book, there's a character, his name's the Chameleon. And he creates a lot of addictive software codes or a lot of downloadable things or creates implants that give you ecstasy-like experiences, but they aren't good for your health. They're like heroin, except now they're in the form of software and implants. So that's one dark side, is that they're going to be used for things that are actually not that good for your nerve and create a kind of a whole new type of drug market. And again, one of the fundamental themes is what happens when these devices are hackable? What happens if somebody gets at, or something, is as is the case with the book, gets access to this and, you know, manipulates you? Because I think fundamentally, one of the things I think that is a fundamental fear of humans is loss of autonomy, meaning this idea of whether it be possession in the religious sense, which has existed for the last, 2,000-3,000 years, to now of somebody manipulating an implant that manipulates your behavior, forces your body to do things that your mind wouldn't want you to do. And again, I think those are theoretical risks and things that we have to guard against.
You have had your work compared to that of Isaac Asimov in the sense that Asimov, writing in the 1960s, was looking forward to the 20th century and predicting everything from what we now know as commonly cell phones and so much more. So it aligns with what you've been working with for the past two decades, and that is the brain-computer interface.
Yes. I mean, I think as far as things that I'm predicting is that you will start to see the line between human, wet biology and computer hard technology become very, very blurry. That I think we will see kind of one technical evolution that I think we are going to see is you'll see neurotechnologies, whether it be implantable or not implantable, go from a restorative therapy where, for instance, in the next two decades, one can envision implanting devices to restore function in patients with spinal cord injury, devices that are implanted to restore function for stroke, replacement parts where basically chips are implanted to fix ailing networks in the brain, such as in the case of Alzheimer's. But just as plastic surgery changed from a restorative therapy, where, for instance, breast reconstruction, facial surgery was done for people who had cancer or who had traumas, transition from restorative to augmenting, meaning that now it's done to enhance your beauty or enhance your body preference. You'll see the same thing happening with neurotechnology, where it'll go from restoring people with stroke to giving people cognitive advancements, whether it be improving their level of attention, enhancing their memory, giving them easy access to information. So that's, I think, one technical trend that I would predict. The second is, as we become better and better at decoding the brain, knowing how the brain represents information and knowing how it processes it to create this wonderful thing that we call a human being, is that we can then, once we really know how that's done by the brain, then we will use biology to inform the technology, this idea of neuromorphic computing or neuromorphic chips. And we're already seeing it happen. We're seeing chips that can change themselves and learn with incoming input. And so I think with the dawn of neuroprosthetics, brain-computer interfaces, decoding the brain, you'll see a dawn of artificial intelligence, true artificial intelligence, which will run to a degree in parallel and somewhat afterwards. And then finally, I think the combination of those two, we'll really see kind of the barriers of how we see our personhood and how we see kind of our human bodies and our machine bodies really change, and kind of envisioning a world where, in some senses, our brains are simply CDs, right? Where we kind of used to think that information had to have a physical carrier, meaning like a CD, a thumb drive, a DVD. And that's transitioned to kind of scenarios where now we see things like music, movies, kind of streaming in essentially wirelessly through kind of cloud computing, where there is no one physical carrier. And will we see an era when, for instance, if information is truly, if the information of our minds and our consciousnesses that is currently carried by the brain can be carried digitally, what does that mean to us in terms of the need for our physical bodies? And again, that sounds kind of out there, but again, you know, I certainly recognize that. But you know, thinking about in terms of a logical progression for things that are happening today in laboratories, people can control devices with their thoughts. We're slowly but surely learning to decode brain activity from the firing of single neurons or billions of neurons. We've shown today that you can put in false memory in mice. So the things that I certainly that I project in my novel Red Devil 4 are linearly projected from things that are happening in laboratories today.
In case you're just tuning in, talking with Dr. Eric Luthart, the book is Red Devil 4. I should ask you before I say any more, how about a website, blog, or tweet, anything else you might want to recommend folks check out?
So kind of, you know, a very easy way to find out more about me or my book is www.reddevil4.com, reddevil4.com. I'm on Twitter, you know, at Eric Luthart, and I have a Facebook page, Eric C. Luthart.
I'll have those repeated at the end of the show as well.
Great.
This is Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. If you're just tuning in and would like to hear the beginning of this program, check us out at publicradioexchange.org under Ideasphere or at National Public Radio's home site, npr.org. If you have any questions, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. Something you're just talking about with reference to these ingenious devices that may occur at one time or another in the future. It's not that far away, according to the New York Times. The article that most recently was released is that there's going to be a computer chip based on the biological nervous system soon.
That's right. Again, I think that it's an interesting dynamic that we're seeing. Again, and technology's racing here, is that we're learning more about neurons in the brain, and that's informing how we make our next generation of technology. And that interaction is that as we get better with creating better computers, we learn more about the brain. As we learn more about the brain, we improve the computers, and back and forth we go. And until, I think, again, we're going to see that boundary, that limitation between the two technologies start to disappear.
All right. So the world of tomorrow, it sounds as though it's here today, that we literally are going to start seeing these changes coming out rapidly. It's just going to happen in a flurry over the next decade.
Certainly, we're going to see a rapid movement of neurotechnology. Again, that it's really the next great era of science, understanding how the brain works. And we're as we learn more about it, we're going to see more and more technical applications. Again, I think the initial iterations will be medical and restorative, helping people with stroke, spinal cord injury, trauma, Alzheimer's. But I think once we do that, then we will see a new era of cosmetic neuroscience, where we basically can start to tune and change ourselves as we see appropriate. Now, the exact timeline, I think we're talking decades.
Okay.
But I really don't think it's an issue of if it'll happen. It's really a question of when it'll happen.
You put the date for your book, Red Devil 4, at 2053.
So that's right.
That's only 40 years away.
I think we'll see it within our lifetimes.
Yeah. So your characters in there are all up to date, that is contemporary, and they have, speaking of up to date, they've updated their inserts or whatever you want to call it.
Prosthetic, yeah.
Yeah, there's prosthetics that are making their day. Everything is happening at once. So the question that's going to arise to anybody reading this is, how am I as a human being, because it's just almost unfathomable, going to be able to distinguish and switch from reality-based and virtual-based, where I am interacting with someone in my mind?
You know, that is, it's interesting. So certainly the characters in the book had different levels of being, quote unquote, plugged in, meaning that there's certain characters like her name is Tara Desner, is an ex-Navy SEAL, and she's intensely pro-technical. You know, she literally drives her motorcycle with her mind, and she sees it as an extension of her body. Now, But then I think there's going to be a lot of people like the older Detective Krantz who struggles with this. He struggles to, you know, and every once in a while he's accidentally saying things, you know, to himself that gets publicly transmitted, and it's uncomfortable and it's rude. It's almost like passing gas in public.
Yes.
And then so he has a tough time. And then I think there'll be a mixture of how people respond to that. Now, to your point, you know, how distinguishable will the virtual reality that's literally created in our brain be from actual reality? At some point, if they're really successful, it will be indistinguishable. And kind of my book, it's not perfect yet. And again, it's intended to be not perfect. In that world, in Red Devil, it's simply monochromatic. That, you know, they haven't got past what we call the phosphine barrier, where you can see colors in addition to shapes and composition. And so when it really does become identical, you're probably going to need indicators, right? That you should know that versus whether you're in the real world. And in some senses, we almost, when we are interacting with our digital content now, whether it be these virtual kind of chat rooms or whatever, they have to tell you when you're online, offline, who you're interacting with, you know, and your camera's on and everything. So I think we'll see more and more indicators trying to inform us of what the content is that's coming in.
And the content sometimes, and this is what I think is going to shake up most of today's generation, maybe not in 40 years, but this is visuals that we'll actually see, not only what we'd think of as the computer screen with all the printout, but in some cases, the complete visuals. So we're seeing an enactment of a scene that's already taken place, or we're going to visualize this other reality.
Yeah, well, I would even go one step further. You're going to fully sense another reality, meaning you'll see it, you'll hear it, you'll feel it, you'll taste it, you'll smell it, as if you are truly experiencing it through the senses of another human being or the virtually rendered senses of somebody who never existed. But true immersion of all your senses being artificially created as if it was real.
Okay, at what point do we become bicameral, or our mind is splitting in so many different directions? Can we maintain sanity through that?
I think so. You know, because in some senses, I think we would have similar arguments 30 years ago. Think of how much of a digital overlay there is in our world already. Technology is getting closer and closer to us. We wear our cell phones. People are wearing Google glasses. We have our ear dongles on. And you know what? Humans seamlessly shift between data streams. And actually, I think there's some very interesting neuroscience for kind of how humans adopt tools, technology, and technology. There's a group out of Japan who did research on this on monkeys when they were recording signals from the monkey's sensory cortex, basically their sense of touch. And what they did was, first off, they mapped out kind of the perceptions of touch on the monkey's hand before the experiment. They showed, you know, when they would touch certain parts of his hand, certain areas would activate in that part of the brain. And then they trained the monkey to feed himself with a little rake. And he consistently would learn to feed himself and pick up the peanuts with the rake and eat them. And after a while, they actually started recording brain activity when they would touch the rake. And there was activations in the sensory cortex when they would touch the rake. And the point of that, and I think why that was so fundamental, was that the rake quite literally became an extension of that monkey's body, right? He perceived it as a part of himself, as we saw in his brain activity. And in some senses, the primate brain is really geared to take on tools and adopt them as a part of the meanness of things. And so just as today, like I wear glasses, I wear a watch, and that's a part of who I am. And certainly, for instance, when you're driving a car and if you ever hit your tire against the curb and you hear that grating sound when your hub is hitting the bumper and it physically hurts you, right? And because in some senses, that car is an extension of your body and it physically hurts when that car gets damaged. Similarly, I would say a lot of people would argue that they feel a little bit less intelligent when they don't have their smartphone on them. And again, I think that we as a species are naturally geared towards adding things that are part of our bodies. And I think that this will be a natural extension of what we are used to doing for the last 40,000 years.
The book is Red Devil 4, Dr. Eric Luthart. Check out his website at reddevil4.com. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back. You're back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. Red Devil 4, Dr. Eric Luthart, Director of the Center for Innovation and Neuroscience and Technology at University Washington School of Medicine, where he researches brain-computer interfaces and ranked as one of the most prolific inventors in the world, with more than 800 patents granted or pending. Okay, you've mentioned Chameleon and the detectives, Tara and Krantz, but you didn't mention one of the lead characters here, and that's Dr. Merici. The reason I want to bring him in now, you're talking about these things being an extension of ourselves, an automobile, which, yes, we take care of and we want it to maintain high quality while we're using it. But then we go a step farther. With Dr. Merici, he has created, figuratively, a son.
That's right. Dr. Merici is one of the main characters in the book, and he's, in some senses, a little bit of an obsessive neurosurgeon whose his life's work is to create artificial intelligence. And again, artificial intelligence and brain-computer interfaces are two sides of the same coin, meaning as we learn more about how the brain works, we can learn more how to create it artificial. And he's working, he's struggling to create OMID, his artificial intellect. And he's, interestingly, just as I think how humans learn, I think that you're going to see artificial intelligence learn, you learn by interaction. He's constantly interacting. He's trying to teach him abstract thoughts and concepts. He grills him on proverbs, for instance, throughout the book. You're right. It truly becomes kind of a dear person to him. And that relationship really, through the book, grows in a lot of really interesting and unique ways.
It's interesting in so many ways. As a reader, you're following his work step by step, as you, the writer, describing the feelings that Merici has. Mm-hmm. And we have OMID, who is completely, let's say, disengaged from the emotional side, and yet expressing some element of feeling until a major breakthrough. It's such a major breakthrough that the doctor is taken by surprise and concern at the same time.
That's right. When he suddenly asserts his autonomy, that he asserts his notion that I am right and you are wrong, and it's in some senses a little bit of rebellion, that he has to disagree with his creator. He's no longer simply taking instructions, but he takes on his ownership of his own ideas. And that really starts to signal the breaking of kind of him being simply kind of something where information is being put in, but there's actually a creation of a sense of ideas and beliefs and notions that then leads him along the way of not just being the recipient of a relationship, but the creator of a relationship.
What would you like readers to take away from with this book? A message besides morality and self-respect that you would like to get through?
Well, again, I tried to paint an incredibly realistic world in the setting of, you know, again, this is a thriller. There's going to be times that it scares the heck out of you. There's going to be times that it fascinates you. It's a fast-paced book, but it really tries to explore the very real textured world of what looks like when our brain is as accessible as a laptop today, and kind of all the unusual things that it means to us personally and how it affects our society and the many different layers from casual interactions to constitutional laws to crime and fundamentally morality. And there's a lot of themes, I think, that go similar in some sense to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the relationship between creator and created, father to son, and how kind of sometimes that's positive, sometimes it's negative, and how sometimes things that get created are unintentional, some of the risks that happen in a modern environment. And what I mean by that is a lot of people talk about what happens when we create artificial intelligence and it gets out of control? And what happens when we create brain-computer interfaces and it gets out of control? And certainly my book touches on a number of those items. But I think even more interesting is what happens when the technical environment that we have created is so complex that it creates its own things that are completely beyond our control, meaning that we're essentially creating a technical milieu similar to kind of the milieu that started life 4 billion years ago that is capable of generating new life. And how do we start to deal with that?
Learning from itself.
Exactly.
And this you mentioned in that last segment there that you saw this through a morality lens as well. And that's what's interesting in reading this, because you get down into the potential adjustments and changes in our laws that are going to accommodate the vast abilities of the computers.
That's right. Yeah, there's kind of my Reichardt's laws of artificial intelligence. So for instance, that similar to Asimov's laws of robotics, Asimov always assumed that something artificially intelligent would have a physical body, right? And so he kind of created physical rules that you don't hurt, you know, a human, you don't do it, things that can lead to human being hurt, you don't break the rules so that those things can happen. In the future, it's really all about information, because an artificial intellect may not have a body, and the things that can really affect a human are not so much going over and punching you, but rather how it can alter the information that humans create that are in humans or viruses. And also, if you truly have an artificial intelligent creature, that is essentially immortal. And so they can't reduplicate themselves, because they can essentially create themselves to infinity, right? And so they're not allowed to duplicate themselves.
This is something too. Okay, with all of this advancement, with all of this technology and the beauty that might come out of it, we still succumb to human frailties. So your character, the chameleon, is dealing in drugs, but not just what we'd think of as popping a pill. This is something that can change your reality through your computer and create something similar to opium or heroin or you name it.
Or really custom tailored to you. And so, for instance, one of his main clients is a evangelical preacher who gets this intense sense of moral spirituality, that he feels moral righteousness with the drug that he takes. And again, the future drugs may be not so much crystal meth or heroin, which are physical things, but actually software code. And so there really is a kind of a number of different levels that this will affect kind of, the moral and the laws and kind of people in various different dimensions.
And it's going to affect many of the readers. Thank you so much, Dr. Luthart. It's been a pleasure reading your work and meeting with you via telephone.
Pleasure for me as well. It was a great conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it greatly.
Okay, bye now.
Bye. Red Devil 4, Dr. Eric Luthart. A neurosurgeon and biomedical engineer, Luthart is a pioneer in neuroprosthetics. He's the director of the Center for Innovation in Neuroscience and Technology at Washington University School of Medicine. He researches brain-computer interfaces. Luthart is also an inventor, having 800 patents granted or pending. His website, reddevil4.com. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.